from our weatherproof bunker deep below ground, the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service, present the current issue of the Indie Week. Reading for our blind and print-impaired listeners, I am John Fetterson. And as today's musical group, the Moles of Melody, tunnel over to the lounge to await our closing theme, I open the new issue of Indie Week, dated February 19th, 2020. And executive editor Jeff C. Billman has an opening column that I thought I would read, Black and White and Dead All Over. On Thursday, McClatchy Company, which owns the Charlotte Observer, the News and Observer, and the Durham Herald Sun, along with 27 other newspapers in 13 other states, filed for bankruptcy. It was less of a surprise than a shock. The company had been burdened by debt from the acquisition of Knight Ridder in 2006 and its own pension fund. If a court agrees to its reorganization proposal, McClatchy will shed 55% of its debt and offload most of its pension obligations to the feds. In the short term, its papers shouldn't be affected. The downside is what comes next. After 163 years, the McClatchy family would give up control of the company. The hedge fund Chatham Asset Management would take over and take the company private. Chatham has media experience, a controlling stake in American Media Incorporated, which owns the National Enquirer, Men's Journal, Us Weekly, and other publications. It said last week that it's, quote, committed to preserving independent journalism and newsroom jobs. Maybe. Chatham isn't the worst hedge fund that could own McClatchy. That would be Alden Global Capital, the industry vulture founded by Duke alum Heath Freeman that has systematically dismembered once great papers like the Denver Post. Alden may get a crack at McClatchy yet. The question is what Chatham does once McClatchy's balance sheets are cleaned up, probably mid-year. This is an age of media consolidation, after all. Last year, McClatchy made a play for Tribune, which rejected its overtures. The new McClatchy will look more attractive, and a merger's cost savings will make financial sense. As the Nieman Labs Ken Doctor has reported, Alden owns about a third of Tribune stock and is already pulling strings inside the company. On June 30th, around the time McClatchy likely emerges from bankruptcy, Alden's agreement not to pursue a hostile takeover of Tribune will expire. So it's not hard to envision a future in which Alden has swallowed up and started slicing and dicing Tribune, and McClatchy becomes part of that hollowed-out family. That's a worst-case scenario. In more optimistic consolidations, McClatchy or Tribune runs the show instead of Freeman. In the best case, local investors take the North Carolina papers off Chatham's hands. But this business rarely inspires optimism these days, especially when the words hedge fund and newspaper appear in the same story. Continuing to Voices, the third place, Chika Gujarati. During the early 2000s, when I was an undergrad at UNC Chapel Hill, Raleigh wasn't on my short list of hangouts. I knew the area around NC State, which usually warranted the rare trip to Raleigh in the first place. Beyond that, I never found a compelling reason to revisit. So almost 15 years later, when my husband suggested we leave Chicago to make the City of Oaks our new home, my first thought was still grounded in that tainted opinion. I quickly blurted out, what the heck is there to do in Raleigh? But there are several ways that living in a big city can spoil you. First and foremost, in my opinion, are its third places. That's a phrase coined by sociologist Ray Oldenburg in the late 1990s in his book, The Great Good Place. A third place is a place between home, first, and work, second place, where a community can easily come together to mingle, relax, and get inspired. Third places are low on personal investment. You don't need to dress up or drive long distances or pay a lot of money. They allow you to make last-minute plans with friends. They provide a space that's inclusive for all types of people of all backgrounds and ages, Basically, third places share art, beauty, and community equally to anyone who shows up. One of the best-known examples of a third place in Chicago is Millennium Park, where my friends and I used to meet up with nothing more than a picnic blanket and have a lot of good conversations. Some days we'd catch a free performance by an artist we couldn't otherwise afford, but most of the time we just lazily lingered, talked, and enjoyed the good weather. These rituals only intensified once we became parents because, as it turns out, kids love third places too. And you don't need to clean your home to see your friends. The patchwork of picnic blankets would grow in size, each of us bringing whatever we could to share. My initial hesitation at the thought of moving to Raleigh was really me wondering how much of this experience I would be able to replicate here. The answer has been slowly unraveling these last 4 or so years. In many ways, I've been amazed at how easily I've kept up with my love for the arts and theater in Raleigh and the greater RTP area. Actually, more than what I managed in Chicago. I also feel like I've enjoyed more fancy meals here than back in the day. I'm a proud Raleighite by all means. And in terms of third places, I've found a lot of joy and comfort now that Moore Square Park and Transfer Company Food Hall have opened downtown. Still, with all the development going on, I think we all deserve more than just a couple of options. I'm curious to know how you all feel about the choices you have in your neighborhoods. What are your favorite third places, and why are they important to you? Years after the publication of his book, Oldenburg wrote in a 2014 New York Times column that, quote, "Joyful association in the public domain is far better than watching television in our lifeless subdivisions." I still love my TV more than Oldenburg might approve, but I do hope that city planners spend more time considering not just how many mixed-use condos and office buildings to accommodate, but also community spaces that allow the likes of me to spend more time with my friends without having to clean my home. Our next regular column put together the good, the bad, and the awful. Good. T. Greg Doucette. There are a lot of people who deserve credit for unraveling the UNC Board of Governors' $2.5 million Silent Sam deal with the North Carolina Division of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, which a judge vacated last week. The student journalists at the Daily Tar Heel, whose reporting brought to light all sorts of chicanery. The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, which intervened on behalf of students and faculty, leading to the settlement being tossed, among others. But it's possible none of this would have happened without local attorney, former Board of Governors member, and Indie Voices columnist T. Greg Doucette, who first reported the insanity of the day before Thanksgiving wham-bam lawsuit settlement, then acquired sources inside the SCV who leaked him information, including Commander Kevin Stone's letter to his men bragging that the BOG made a deal, even though it knew the SCV didn't have the standing to sue. That exposed the whole charade for what it was. Bad. Chapel Hill Carborough City Schools. Last week, CHCCS School Board axed a 2-year, $767,000 professional development contract with an organization called Education Elements. The move came 2 months after the board suspended the contract, which came 2 weeks after the board says it first learned about it. By that point, the school system had already shelled out $342,000, though it never voted to approve the contract, and the contract never went through the state-required pre-audit process. How did this happen? According to school board chairwoman Mary Ann Wolfe, since each monthly payment to Education Elements fell below $90,000, the threshold for getting board approval, administrators just decided they could do it on their own. No big deal. And awful. McClatchy Company. Everyone assumed it was coming at one point or another. McClatchy makes a good amount of revenue, but it's saddled with too much debt, both from its acquisition of Knight Ridder and its pension fund. Assuming a judge approves bankruptcy reorganization the company proposed last week, it will shave down that debt and shift the burden of its pension obligations to the federal government, In the short term, its papers, including the News and Observer and the Durham Herald Sun, shouldn't be affected. But longer term, it's hard to be optimistic, either for our local papers or for local journalism generally. McClatchy's new majority owner will be a hedge fund, and a hedge fund that controls National Enquirer and Us Weekly's parent company, no less. Hedge funds, as a rule, don't exist to make public interest journalism. They exist to make profits. All right, and our news columns are following up some of the same issues that we've been following for quite a few weeks now. But this one, after the storm, Lee Taus from Raleigh, the Raleigh Council's decision to eliminate CACs sparked an uproar. What comes next? The City Council's surprise dismantling of citizen advisory councils 2 weeks ago sent shockwaves through the city's political circles. Some neighborhood advocates accused the council of selling out to developers, as CACs offered them an outlet to voice objections to projects. The council's pro-growth supporters rejoiced, calling the CACs a relic of a bygone era and brushing aside the cloak-and-dagger manner with which they were dispatched. On Tuesday, after this issue went to press, the city's staff is scheduled to update the council on its progress finding a consultant to develop a new framework for community engagement. Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin says she doesn't believe one has been chosen yet. Selecting one may require a bidding process, but she's hopeful the staff will sort it out within a month. The decision to end CACs was spearheaded by council newcomer Sage Martin, who whipped votes in secret ahead of the February 4th meeting. Not even council member David Cox knew about the decision before he was handed a paper copy of the four motions Martin prepared. The public was blindsided, too. The motions weren't on the agenda, and the public wasn't given a chance to speak on them. CACs have been around since the 1970s, where they were established in an effort to snag federal block grants. They became a fixture of Raleigh's civic landscape, amassing political power and exerting influence over rezoning cases. 10 rezoning cases are still slated to go before CACs in the next month. The council permitted them to hear pending cases through March 17th. Bob Geary, a City Planning Commission member and former Indy columnist, says the system needed to be reformed, but ditching it altogether, quote, makes little sense. CAC served an important purpose. Still, despite the constraints imposed by the city, the CACs proved useful over many years' time as a common ground for staff and residents to meet and share basic information and to discuss issues as they arose, unquote. Geary has proposed holding planning commission hearings at night to fill in the void left behind by CACs and make meetings more accessible for residents. That idea won't be vetted until the commission's March retreat. Meanwhile, Cox, a CAC proponent, attempted to take matters into his own hands, vowing on his blog to hold community meetings of his own. However, when he asked City Manager Ruffin Hall if he could use staff members at these meetings, he was told he'd need the full council's approval, Cox posted on Facebook last week. Cox, who also suggested on Facebook that the council's CAC vote could sour him on affordable housing and parks bonds, expected to be on the ballot in November, did not return a call seeking comment. Baldwin says Cox's inquiry will be clarified at Tuesday's meeting, although she did not elaborate. Former City Council member Steph Mendel has been an outspoken advocate online for bringing back CACs. She, too, didn't return a phone call seeking comment. On Saturday, Mendel shared on Twitter that one of the more than 200 Wake County Democratic Party precincts voted unanimously in favor of a resolution to reinstate CACs. The county party will consider such resolutions at its convention in March. The City Council is comprised of seven Democrats and one unaffiliated member. Residents will still have the opportunity to learn about rezoning cases through meetings held by developers, as required by city code, Baldwin says, and the council might add a second required meeting for cases deemed impactful. Residents within 1,000 feet of the proposed rezoning would be notified about those meetings. Since the council voted to eliminate CACs, Martin has been meeting with CAC chairs to discuss the next step. Although he acknowledges that, quote, the process sucked, He says it was a necessary evil. Now, he argues, there's hope that the city's 2021 budget might include an office of community engagement that would allow residents to weigh in on the affordable housing and parks bonds. No matter what we did, there was going to be a storm, Martin says. There was no process that was going to be perfect. My goal was to move as quickly as possible to get to the end result. Now a column from Julia Hayward called Swing Open the Door. 4 years after HB2, Gray Ellis wants to become the first transgender man ever elected to a state legislature. On a warm summer day in 1977, a group of neighborhood kids spilled into the kitchen of the Ellis family home in Whiteville, a small town in rural Columbus County, awaiting popsicles. "Line up, girls first," Gray's mother called out. The four-year-old walked to the back of the line. His mom caught Gray's attention. "Girls first," she repeated. "I heard you." Gray didn't have the vocabulary to describe how he felt. He wouldn't know the word transgender until he was much older. He only knew that he didn't feel like a girl. "I knew I identified as male," he says, "but what that meant I didn't know, and I thought I was the only person in the world like me." His grandfather preached at the town's Pentecostal church, and his father was the choir director. But Ellis stresses that the town embraced him. He never told his grandfather or anyone about his gender identity, but his grandfather referred to him with masculine pronouns and, as he neared death, offered him one of his prized suits. It was, he says, one of his first gender-affirming experiences. "I really don't know whether he just knew and accepted it," Ellis says, "but it was never vocalized." Finding people like him, however, meant leaving Whiteville. The day he graduated high school, he packed all his belongings into a white convertible Mustang and drove to the Triangle to attend NC Central, his first step toward law school. 3 decades later, Ellis, now 47, is a family lawyer whose firm has locations in Pittsburgh and Durham, where he lives with his son and partner. He transitioned at age 39. He's been living as an openly transgender man for almost a decade. He says Durham welcomed him. "I've had shockingly little backlash," he says. "People just accepted me for who I was. Part of that is luck, and part of that was just who I was as a person. I've never been polarizing, despite being a trans person. I cross bridges with a lot of people." Now he's seeking to become the first transgender person elected to not only the General Assembly, but to any state legislature in the country. Ellis is running against Natalie Murdoch and Pierce Freeland in the Democratic primary for the District 20 State Senate seat, until recently held by Floyd McKissick Jr. He's already the first transgender man to run for any elected office in North Carolina. This is part of a trend. As stigmas surrounding sexual and gender identities recede, more and more LGBTQ people, including, notably, former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who is among the top tier of Democratic presidential hopefuls after the Iowa and New Hampshire contests, are seeking public office. All of this is happening less than 5 years after the U.S. Supreme Court made same-sex marriage legal nationwide, and 4 years after Republicans in the General Assembly targeted transgender people with HB2. "We've seen a dramatic increase in the last 2 years," said Elliot Imes, communications director for the Victory Fund, a political action committee that helps elect LGBTQ people. "There are still only 841 LGBTQ elected officials, meaning that we're just 0.1% of those in elected office." In 2018, Danica Rim was elected to the Virginia House of Delegates, becoming the country's first openly transgender woman and transgender person to take office. Since then, the Victory Fund says 20 more transgender women and 5 transgender men have won elections, too. Places that are more welcoming to LGBTQ people have more LGBTQ people in office, Ims says. "When LGBTQ people are in the halls of power, we influence the debate. We humanize LGBTQ lives for legislative colleagues, and that leads to more inclusive legislation. Advocates hope that could be the case in North Carolina as well. In addition to making it a crime for transgender people to use public facilities that conform with their gender identity, HB 2, the so-called bathroom bill, also prohibited local governments from enacting non-discrimination ordinances that protected LGBTQ people. While the law was repealed amid a furious backlash in 2017, its replacement, HB 142, kept that prohibition through the end of this year. Ellis is one of three transgender people who will appear on ballots in the area next month. Angela Bridgman is running for state senate as well in District 18, Wake County. Wendy May is making a second bid for Johnston County Commissioner. Her first effort in 2016 made her the first transgender person to seek office in North Carolina. "I faced a lot of hate," says May, who also identifies as non-binary. "In reality, I'm not running because I'm transgender or non-binary. I'm running because I'm an advocate." Bridgman, the first transgender woman to run for the General Assembly, says the positive response she got from her community after HB 2 passed inspired her to run. "A whole bunch of people became my ally," Bridgman says. "People stood up for me. It really shook me out of my complacency." Like Bridgman and May, Ellis says he's not running simply as a transgender candidate. He's focused on progressive issues like expanding Medicaid and improving education. But being a transgender candidate has brought national attention, including an endorsement from the Victory Fund and a profile in The Advocate. Still, Ellis is likely an underdog in a marquee contest. Murdoch has the backing of the influential Durham People's Alliance, PAC, while Freelon, the son of a world-famous architect and a Grammy-nominated jazz singer, not to mention a former mayoral candidate and a well-regarded musician in his own right, is supported by Mayor Steve Shule and other city politicos. Whatever happens on March 3rd, Ellis says he's super proud of his campaign. "I hope that what I'm doing, win or lose, is going to help bring about changes and is going to open up doors where people didn't even know there was a door to go through," he says. Next from Durham, Cameron Beach's column, Insult to Injury. After a Duke student was raped, Duke Hospital sent bill collectors after her. This story was produced through a partnership between Indy and the Ninth Street Journal, which is published by journalism students at Duke University's Center for Media and Democracy. It was early morning on December 13, 2018. A Duke student was sitting in her apartment's common room on the university's central campus. She was cramming for her organic chemistry final when a man she didn't know opened the door. She says the stranger entered, threatened her with a knife, and raped her. The student and a sophomore immediately went to the Duke Hospital emergency room. She wanted a sexual assault nurse examiner to collect a rape kit, an invasive evidence collection process that often takes hours and requires victims to describe the details of their assault. But that kit could provide crucial evidence for police to catch her assailant. Police have not announced any arrests in the case, but 6 months after the assault, the student received a call from a number she didn't recognize. "This is a call from a debt collection agency for Duke Health," the person said, according to the student. The caller informed her she had owed hundreds of dollars for her emergency room visit for the rape examination. "Before that, I had no idea I owed any money," the student, who asked not to be identified, told Ninth Street Journal. "I asked them to talk to my mom because it was really traumatic and hard, but they didn't do that. They kept calling me over and over again." Rape victims are not supposed to be charged for sexual assault exams, but the rules have loopholes. The Federal Violence Against Women Act requires that all states cover the cost of the exams. But beyond the exams themselves, each state can decide what additional hospital services they'll cover. North Carolina's interpretation is called the Rape Victims Assistance Program. The program offers hospitals up to $800 for a sexual assault exam, $350 for the sexual assault nurse examiner, $250 for the hospital facility, and $200 for other expenses, including sexually transmitted disease, antibiotics, or pregnancy tests for the victim. Victims should never be directly billed by a hospital for the examination, according to the North Carolina Department of Public Safety. But Molly Chadbourne, a former sexual assault nurse examiner in Durham, says victims still get charged for other services. There are still fees for checking into the hospital, getting an x-ray, or for needing other care, she explains. All that other stuff patients can get charged for. Sexual assault patients definitely get bills. Chadbourne says some states cover all of a sex assault victim's other hospital bills, while others cap their payments at a certain amount. She notes the $800 cap in North Carolina and says $800 is nothing at a hospital. Though the Violence Against Women Act is supposed to protect victims from being billed after a sexual assault, many women have reported experiences like the students, according to accounts in news articles and on websites. The practice is caused by a combination of state policy, billing mistakes, and poor communication between debt collectors and hospitals. When the student went to Duke Hospital, she didn't bring her insurance card. They said that was fine at the time, she says. She was told she wouldn't have to pay for a sexual assault exam and she didn't have to worry about billing. A few hours after the assault, police sent a Duke Alert, the university's warning system for crime and severe weather. A student reported that between 1 and 3 a.m. this morning, she was awakened by a white male with short brown hair and a perfume smell about him. The alert emailed to students, faculty, and staff. He threatened her with a knife, put on a condom, and forced her to have sex. The student was embarrassed by the detailed university-wide alert. Reading the email was really hard, she says. They never asked me if it was okay to send out that email or if I even wanted to talk to the police. They just said, you need to talk to this officer, and I did it because it felt like I had to. Months after the assault, she was beginning to heal. She was put in contact with the Duke Women's Center and started seeing a psychiatrist. Duke Hospital has an online billing system, but the student says she didn't think she would have bills, so she never checked it. After 4 months, Duke Health sends all unpaid medical bills to debt collection agencies. Then she got the first call from a debt collector. The calls kept coming. We are a debt collector, said the voicemail. This call is an attempt to collect a debt, and any information obtained will be used for that purposes. They're always from a random number and never the same number twice, the student says. I told them my insurance card information, and I got confirmation that everything was worked out over the summer, but they continue to call and say we owe them even more. When she called Duke Health to report what was happening, the billing office told her she had an outstanding charge. She asked that the debt collectors contact her mom instead so she wouldn't have to explain her situation to strangers. She and her mom are still working through the bill. Her bill from her emergency room visit on December 13th is labeled as Accounts with Collections Agency in Duke's online billing system, but she says she has difficulty determining how much she owes because the collectors have a separate billing system. The collectors keep calling every few months. The student authorized Duke Health to discuss her bills with the Ninth Street Journal, but a Duke Health spokeswoman declined to comment on the student's situation. Across the country, victims have reported getting billed by hospitals after a sexual assault. We definitely hear about this, says Grace Francis, the director of community partnerships at End Violence Against Women International, a nonprofit that educates professionals about sexual assault. It is definitely still a problem. In 2017, a study published in the American Journal of Public Health found that the average hospital bill after a rape was $6,700. After billing insurance, sex assault victims were left with an average of $948 to pay out of pocket, and 88% of medical records indicated that victims were charged on the day they visited the hospital. Oftentimes, the charges that they're seeing aren't the cost of the rape kit, says Ashley Tennessee, lead researcher on the study and an assistant professor at the Medical University of South Carolina. Most people who are sexually assaulted have additional costs. They might want tests completed or treatments for physical abuse. Tennessee sees the problem as twofold. Victims are sometimes mistakenly charged for their rape exam kit, but more often they're billed for treatment related to their sexual assault. If victims check into the emergency room, they can also be charged a facility fee. Duke itself acknowledges that going to its emergency room will cost patients, quote, at least $1,000. Asked if Duke Health has a policy about charging for sexual assault exams, a spokeswoman declined to comment. Tennessee recommends that states broaden their policies to reimburse hospitals for more than just the sexual assault exam. She also hopes that hospitals will charge sex assault victims through a separate billing process to ensure that no mistakes are made. Someone has to pay for it, she says. At this point, it's the victim. For sexual assault survivors who have been billed by hospitals in North Carolina, there is another option, the Crime Victim Compensation Fund. Victims of violent crime can apply for medical compensation of up to $30,000, including physical treatment and future counseling. But there are bureaucratic hurdles that can be challenging for survivors of sexual assault. To submit a claim, a victim must provide a police report. That means they have to report their rape to police before they're eligible for the compensation. I think you should be able to come to the emergency room and say, I was sexually assaulted, I want to get medical care, and get that for free, Chadbourne says. But that's not how it works. Even for victims who are eligible to apply to the compensation fund, there are still barriers. They have to collect documents and get them notarized before submitting their application and will likely wait months to receive compensation. And in the meantime, they'll still be billed for their sexual assault exam visit. It's unacceptable, Francis says. You're telling victims that you don't care what it means to them when they get a bill on the mail and their family sees it. It's putting the responsibility on the victims to get themselves reimbursed, Chadbourne says, and that's hard. For the Duke student, it's also confusing. We're unsure about what the bill is for at this point because we've already paid so much, she says. She also feels betrayed by the institution that failed to protect her while on campus. I hated their whole response, she says. They just sent us to a collection agency. All right, in Raleigh, the Gregg Museum of Art and Design has a reception for an exhibition of Mary Ann Scher's legacy in metal. And Sarah Edwards has written this article, Wearable Possibilities. One night in 1969, Mary Ann Scher was up late working on a design she'd been commissioned to make for Miss Ohio in the Miss Universe competition. She didn't find beauty pageants particularly stimulating, but while watching the Ohio-born astronaut Neil Armstrong take his first stuttering steps across the moon as an on-screen monitor displayed his heartbeat, she grew inspired. That year, Miss Ohio would walk across stage wearing a glammed-out spacesuit with a heart-monitoring belt. Such anecdotes, which distill so neatly into parables about beauty, function, and futurism, are the essence of Mary Ann Scher, who died in Raleigh in 2016 at the age of 94. All is possible. Mary Ann Scher's legacy in metal, a new exhibit that opens on Thursday at the NC State's Gregg Museum, honors her legacy, which looms large in the world of jewelry and industrial design, and even larger in the lives of her students. Curator Anna Estrades says the title of the exhibit is a motto that Scher often repeated and liked to applique into her jewelry designs. A pioneer in the use of exotic materials such as pyrite and titanium, she believed in the unlimited possibilities of metal as well as the possibilities of the lives around her. It's not over till it's over, jewelry designer Sui Jin Lee remembers her former teacher saying, every day over your life, you need to live it fully. Scher taught at Meredith College, Duke, and NC State, among other institutions. Upon her death, obituaries noted she was beloved by thousands of students. Meanwhile, her far-reaching designs could be found in the permanent collections of the Met, Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, Vatican Museum is in the private collections of Liz Claiborne, and the U.S. Steel Corporation. This exhibit, though, is the first retrospective of her work to be shown in Raleigh, where she lived for the last 27 years of her life. Scher was born in 1921 to working-class parents in Akron, Ohio. Her mother was a seamstress, her father a skilled mechanic, At the age of 17, he invented a threading mechanism that would be adopted by every rubber company in the world. Not that the family profited from it. Unaware of the invention's potential, he sold the licensing to Goodrich for $1. Schur took after her parents and began drawing at an early age. She often used her allowance to buy oversized sheets of paper from a local bakery for drawing. After high school, she interviewed to be a clerk at a local store. The interview went well enough, she thought, but afterward the owner asked to speak with her mother. "I am not hiring your daughter, because if I do, she'll never go on to study art," he said. "I'm telling you to let her go to art school." Upon Schur's acceptance into the Cleveland Institute of Art, her parents mortgaged the family home to pay for tuition. She began experimenting with different mediums. Jewelry was not one of them. "I wanted to be a sculptor and a painter and a designer," Schur said in an oral history with the Smithsonian Institution. "I was interested in everything but metals." Then came the war. She dropped out of school and found work as an illustrator and cartographer, detouring from her visual art ambitions entirely when she went on the road for a year as a dancer. After the war, she married Sam Schur, a childhood friend, and was hired as an interior and accessory designer at Ford. She was one of the first, many say the first, female designers at the company and could have carved out a distinctive career in cars, but she grew restless. "My background reads like a telephone book," Schur said, "because once the work became too familiar, I had to move on and on." In the late 1940s, she moved to Akron, where Sam Schur opened up an industrial design firm, and she became pregnant with their first child. Restless again, she enrolled in a night class for jewelry making. Much of the jewelry popular today has been designed with an eye toward restraint. In catalogs, pearls, pendants, and thin gold rings disappear into the bodies of models. In the middle-class jewelry market of strip malls and snowy Jared ads, only diamond rings stand out as objects engineered to demand attention. They signify romantic attachment, constancy. Once you have a diamond ring on, you're not meant to ever take it off. Schur's designs rebuff tradition. They're not diminutive, and most pieces on display at the Greg would be impractical to wear on a daily basis. There is an imposing physicality about the way her signature cuffs take up space on a wrist or neck. They look royal and assertive and a little wild, like jewelry you might find in the wreckage of a Viking ship. When admiring certain designs, it's easy to find evidence of her past career in the automotive industry. The flash and heft of a hubcap is always close at hand. By definition, many of these one-of-a-kind designs are couture. But that category doesn't feel right for Schur's work, which firmly pushed form into function. Jewelry was art, yes, but it was also more than art. It was something that could be essential to living. Miss Ohio's belt was only one of Schur's forays into wearable and biosensing technology. On display at the Greg are a sleep detector and an electronic oxygen pendant. A 1981 New York Times piece detailed Schur refashioning hospital-issue medical hardware into necklaces for women who had had tracheostomies, which she described as compassionate jewelry. Prices started at $100. In 1982, while Schur was chair of the product design department at Parsons, I assume that's the Parsons School of Design, she helped create a series of jewelry designs that monitored vital functions. In an interview about the designs later that year, Schur anticipated the dawn of technology like the Fitbit and the Apple Watch. "The time will come when life monitoring jewelry will be as common as wristwatches, and no one will think of leaving home without a heart or air monitor," she said. "I can already envision a bracelet or ring that would be a timepiece, a body monitor, and a telephone." By the 1980s, she had earned considerable clout in the New York art world with a client list that included Vice President Walter Mondale, the Duke of Windsor, and Andy Warhol, who bought one of her cookie jars for his collection. When it appears in the background of a prominent picture in the Times, the value of her jars skyrocketed. She and Sam shared a 5,000-square-foot Soho loft on Broadway Avenue. She was at the height of her career. And then they packed up their belongings and moved to Raleigh. Famously tiny and draped in black, her wrists webbed with gold and silver designs, and her feet outfitted in stilettos, sure stood out in North Carolina. Moving south from New York in one's 60s is not a seamless endeavor. She came here kicking and screaming, her daughter Sydney sure says. Sam's health had deteriorated, though, and all three of the couple's children lived in Raleigh. Sure had connections with the state from teaching at the Penland Center for the Arts. It made sense. And soon, with the distractions of New York behind her, she threw herself into yet another chapter of that immense telephone book of a life. With more time to spend in the studio, her work became more introspective, as she put it. In 2002, Sam died, and in her widowhood, Mary Ann continued to pour her life into the Raleigh arts community. She served on the City Council's Art Commission, joined the Raleigh Fine Arts Society, and co-founded the Roundabout Art Collective. She also continued to teach into her 90s, a vocation that she called a design in itself. She was a very devoted as a mentor and teacher, says Anna Estradis. She felt like it was the face of her legacy. Years ago, Sher gave a sterling silver All Is Possible cuff to Sui-Jin Lee, who will be teaching a metals workshop in conjunction with this exhibit at the NC State Crafts Center this spring. The birthday gift is on display at the Greg. She actually made me promise when she was on her deathbed, you need to carry this on. You need to figure out what you want to do, she says. She was always pushing people forward in a good way. Sher's daughter, Sydney, remembers hiding beneath her mother's desk as a child, watchfully copying her sketches. Sometimes Sydney would nibble on matches as the two worked. My mother was a terrible cook, she says. They probably tasted better than her cooking. But her mother's domestic aptitude had no effect on how Sydney saw her. As with many people who came in contact with Sher, Sydney has gone on to a career in jewelry design. And as many of the people who speak about Sher, light is the frame of reference. Metal seeks luster. So did Mary Ann Sher. She was the light of my life, Sydney says. In literally everything she did, I followed in her footsteps. She was this beacon. Hart Fowler, arts at IndieWeek.com, writes Solid Goldthwaite. In connection with today through Saturday, Bobcat Goldthwaite appearing at Goodnight's Comedy Club. Comedian Bobcat Goldthwaite first rose to fame in the 1980s when his screechy voice stand-up persona crossed over in the Police Academy movie franchise. 30 years later, he settled into a long tenure on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and branched out into filmmaking, but he's still in the road comedy game, and he's got 4 shows at Goodnight this week. He's also recording part of a new comedy special with Dana Gould at the Motherlight in Asheville, at the Mothlight. We recently reached him by phone in L.A. and talked about some of the most memorable moments of a long career, from sparring with Jerry Seinfeld to his long friendship with Robin Williams, the time he beefed with Seinfeld. In the current season of Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, Jerry Seinfeld lambastes a comedian that is understood to be Goldthwaite. They beeped out his name to guest Bridget Everett, a close friend of Goldthwaite, who in the 1990s used to make fun of the banality of Seinfeld's humor in his stand-up. Goldthwaite, in his defense, I have said mean things about the guy, but he had promoted the pilot I had worked on with Bridget on Twitter, so I thought we were all good and didn't have a beef. I guess it goes to show you can be very successful and very rich and still be really unhappy. I felt really bad for Bridget because he was trying to make her feel bad for being my friend. He has all the right to say he doesn't like me. I think he's a little crazy to spend that much time on his joke bashing me in the comedic sense. But I feel that the weird part is when he confuses the love from an audience with self-worth. I mean, I'm happy that crowds like me. It's nice that I can have a good crowd, but I don't confuse that with whether I'm a good person. He's talking about my act that I probably haven't done in 20 years, and he still does the same act from 30 years ago, and that's the filter he's judging me through. Yeah, it's funny. After all these years, he finally has an opinion about something, and it is me. His question was whether I'm funny or not, and comedy is subjective. Some people find Richard Pryor, Andy Kaufman, and George Carlin funny, and other people find it funny to discuss where the socks go in the dryer. Is it like any other kind of art? Is Michael Bolton not a good musician? You know, Michael Bolton worked for a lot of people, and you can't take that away from anyone who connects with someone on an emotional level. But so does Iggy Pop. And I'm just saying, I'm inclined to go to an Iggy Pop concert. Goldthwait opened for Nirvana on their last North American tour, the one on which he famously rappelled nude from the roof of the Oakland Coliseum. I emceed, he says, and if the crowd didn't hate me, I'd do time. Actually, if they did hate me, I'd still do time. Before they broke into the mainstream, I met Kurt because he wanted to interview me for a college radio station in Ann Arbor because he was a fan of my stand-up, which reminds me of how Jimi Hendrix really liked Buddy Hackett. He liked my stand-up, and he would listen to my album over and over. When I met Dave Grohl, he was complaining about that. That time he worked with Judd Apatow. He's currently working with Apatow on a feature film version of Call Me Lucky, Goldthwait's documentary about comedian Barry Crimmins. It reminds me of my relationship with Robin Williams because Judd talks about my work and acts like we are peers, and the reality of it is we're not. Where my movies make hundreds of dollars, his make millions. It's a biopic trying to tell Barry's story. It's a hell of a story. He was a bar comic who was a political satirist, and later in life he disclosed about his child abuse. When he was looking for other survivors in the early 90s, he was on AOL, and they were allowing child pornography to be exchanged. AOL turned a deaf ear to it, and Barry pointed it out, and it ended up on the floor of the Senate, taking on AOL. It's like a Frank Capra story, but from a very unlikely person. It's really sweet and nice of Judd to work on this piece. I've known him since he was a PA on Comic Relief. We worked on the Larry Sanders Show together. He was drawn to the Barry story, and it was something both of us believed in and wanted to do. Finally, that time, he was friends with Robin Williams. Goldthwait and Williams performed and collaborated on countless shows. Goldthwait wrote and directed World's Greatest Dad, which starred the late actor. We were really close friends, and I think we were because he could trust me to be himself around me. I keep that to myself because he's gone. One thing about Robin that I do want people to know was that he was misdiagnosed with Parkinson's, and he had something called Lewy body dementia, which is very aggressive, much more aggressive than Alzheimer's. Him taking his life was not a result of being depressed or the effects of alcohol or drugs. He was sober most of the time for 30 years that I knew him. It was really that his brain gave him misinformation. I don't mean to take anything away from people who have lost people to depression or drugs, but that wasn't Robin's story. If any good comes out of this horrible thing, it is that maybe people will be more aware of Lewy body dementia. And it would be great if people were a little bit more kind with someone's suicide and not just call them weak or judge them. If you have a disease that tells you that it's okay to walk across the street when you think it's red, but it's a green light, that's where my friend was. A music article now connected to Crow Meat Bob, performing at Neptune's Parlor. We Can't Believe Our Ears, written by Harris Wheelis. In 1900, Daniel Paul Schreiber, a former judge who had been institutionalized after a series of mental collapses, began writing a comprehensive account of his experiences to use in an appeal for his release. "I hear words from the talking birds impinging on my ears from outside," Schreiber wrote. "The woodpeckers, blackbirds, and swallows nesting in the asylum garden shouted the same question at him over and over. Are you not ashamed?" Our senses can be unreliable narrators of what's going on around us. Especially in abstract genres such as noise music, there are sounds that may or may not just be a trick of the ear. What are all those things we hear amid the crunch of distortion and hair-raising gale of electronics? Are they really there at all? I think that's the attraction of noise music for a lot of people, says Bob Pence. You're never sure what you're hearing, whether what you're hearing is in your mind or not. Pence, who makes music as Crow Meat Bob, is a horn player and guitarist who's been a mainstay of the Triangle's experimental and free improv scene since he moved to Raleigh in 2000. Judge Schreiber's Avian Choir, his latest project, is his first as a band leader. In October, it released Bleed, an album composed for heavy metal band and strings. The record takes its concept from Schreiber and what he was hearing outside his window. About 120 years later, Pence hands me the notes Schreiber submitted in his defense, printed and bound in a book called Memoirs of My Nervous Illness. We're sitting on the couch in Pence's apartments, bordered on all sides by a musician's equivalent of mounted game. Instruments, lecterns, concert posters, and shelves of records. There's a precarious stack of books on the coffee table with a little desktop sign that says Out to Lunch perched on top. A record by old school Chapel Hill psychobilly band Flat Duo Jets blares on the turntable. Pence says that the Avian Choir Schreiber heard outside the asylum served as a jumping off point for the album's monster movie string theatrics. I think the whole string orchestra thing lends itself to hallucination, Pence says. I was thinking about those dissonant harmonics on the higher end of the spectrum, interacting and creating all those little weird sounds, ghost sounds, whatever you want to call them. If you turn it up really loud, get really high, you can hear all kinds of stuff in it. The album also takes musical cues from two other wildly divergent sources, spectralism, an abstruse style of classic composition informed by the harmonic series, and 90s drone metal bands such as Earth. Just the thought of combining those dense, intense string sounds with the droney heavy metal stuff, I thought that would make for some really cool stuff, Pence says. Orchestral metal is something he's done in live performances since the mid-aughts with the Micro East Collective and other large ensembles, but this is the first time he's done it in a professional recording studio. The blueprint for the record was sketched out in the same place we're sitting. The acoustic guitar resting against the wall is the one Pence used to compose the riffs at the core of Bleed's dense harmonic structure. The album is thrillingly frightening, with screaming strings, sharp peals of horns, raunchy guitar riffs, and a drummer who hauls ass like it's the second coming. With all that overdrive in the guitars and the density of the sound and the harmonics, the overtones, it creates all those tinier molecular rhythms, Pence says. The album was recorded in one session, with some overdubs later, at Fidelatorium in Kernersville. It features a large ensemble, Pence on guitar and reeds, 14 string players, John Farrell on bass and Mike Eisenberg on drums. The tightrope walk was that you had so many people playing at once that everybody had to get it right, says Eisenberg, who has previously played with Pence in bands such as Colima and Savage Nights. Sometimes the rhythm or string section would nail something, but Pence would be aware that something else didn't go right and wave his hand to call it off. Bleed is separated into four parts. Side A, the unfolding, is steeped in the idea of time unfolding in widening intervals with music that follows suit. Riffs extend and repeat. The strings become more dissonant with each second. The drums plod along at their own stubborn pace. And Pence's horn seems to writhe in bodily anguish. The first part of Side A's Zarathustra's Ape begins with a soft drone, before the rhythm section kicks in with a swath of heavy distortion, which morphs into a hulking monolith of fractured sounds. In the feedback and horns, second part, the cardboard cutout spiral sundial starts to take shape. A textured landscape appears, the whisper of a bow on strings, atmospheric static, gradual trills, and finally a needle lapping against dead wax. Side B, The Return, opens with the Bacillus of Revenge, a long string piece in which an extended drone teeters, rattles, and crumbles into a crescendo of bow scraping and violent psycho stabs. As the mist clears, you can hear a sample of the 30s radio show Lights Out, the gong and the doom-laden voice that says, "It is later than you think," before the deafening thrash metal of The Wheel of Ixion brings the record home. If you heard this coming out of a passing car, you'd be halfway home before your groceries hit the ground. But when you approach it intentionally, the effect is one of startling rapture. To Eisenberg, for avant-garde music, it's markedly different rather than rarefied. Things like this can be sort of precious, but I think it has a genuine visceral quality, and the metal parts sound like metal, he says. I don't think anything about it is terribly delicate. I think it's a striking recording. Speaking of music, I hear that our moles of melody have dug their way back into our underground snow shelter, signaling me that I must stop reading this article now and get moving with the closing. After this initial broadcast, the issue of Indie Week can be heard as a podcast on our website, www.NorthCarolinaNCReadingService.org. And the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly the Triangle Radio Reading Service, is intended for blind and print-impaired listeners. All right, I am John Federson, and I will check out to so I can get to be taken back to the up hundreds of feet to the service and to see what the weather is doing out there. And I hope I will make it home. I've got my tennis shoes to wear on my feet in case it snows. So I am John Federson, and tell everyone listening and yourselves to bundle up. Bye-bye for now.